So I'm saying to you, this is marvelous, that the whole Bible story from eternity past to eternity future is one great story of love. God is love. And the whole of the creation is the overflow of this love between Father, Son, and Spirit that has always existed. And our redemption flows out of it because it is all about the Son bringing us into the love that He has always enjoyed, flowing into Him and flowing from Him, communicated between the Father and the Son. Don't you think that's amazing and marvelous that we should be brought into the enjoyment that Jesus has of His own Father's love? So that's why I'm suffering, Jesus says. And that's what I'm asking for. Well, that, of course, is a very good reason for going right to the middle of the Bible and the Song of Solomon, which very significantly is a human love story that obviously points to something much more, which is the big love story that is the whole of the Bible. And we saw last week, as we looked at this together, that it is the story of a king's love for his bride, a king's love for his bride, and the bride's love, therefore, for the king who becomes her husband. And of course, the king in the story is Solomon, the Song of Solomon. And Solomon, if you read earlier in the Bible, was famed around the world for his wealth, fabulously wealthy, Solomon was. And so when this woman marries Solomon and becomes his bride, she enters into the most extraordinary wealth. Immediately, she's going to be surrounded by servants and the most lavish imaginable lifestyle and all that becomes hers because she becomes his. But what's very striking to me as I've read through Song of Solomon and reflected on it over these days is that as far as I can see, she doesn't say a single word about any of that. Not a single word. Her song is not about the lifestyle into which the king has brought her. Her song is about the king himself. It's about her love for the king. And it's about the king's great love for her. And if you want one verse to encapsulate the whole message of the story, it's our verse in chapter 6 and verse 3, in which she says, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine." Now, I want to focus in first on this word beloved, because that's the heart of what it is. We miss it if we miss that it's all about love, a relationship of love. That's the bond that this book is pointing to that is at the very heart of the relationship between Christ and the believer, the bond of love. I want you to consider this first here. As we think about what it means to love, beware of the gold digger mentality. Beware of the gold digger mentality. Now, I checked the dictionary for a definition of the word gold digger, and this is what I found in Merriam-Webster. And actually, to my surprise, it was the first definition and not somewhere down the list. But this is what it says. I Googled it, and this is what came up. Gold digger, a woman who becomes or tries to become romantically involved with a rich man in order to get money and gifts from him. Now, I don't know about you, but that, when I read it, immediately seemed to me to be a somewhat sexist definition, because I'm quite sure that it can and does happen the other way around. So let me, just to balance this up, put it the other way around, and let's paint the picture, and will you think about this with me for a moment? Picture a rich widow. I mean, this woman is loaded. She is very wealthy. She lives in the most marvelous home. She takes the most exotic vacations and so forth and so on. And a man comes alongside her. And he becomes romantically involved with her. And in the end, he marries her. And now he enters into and enjoys all the benefits of the life that he now shares with her, the lavish home, the marvelous and exotic vacations, and so forth and so on. But He does not love her. He never did, and he never will. He does not love her. His whole intent, right from the beginning, was simply that he should have what she enjoys. Now let that picture settle in your mind, and what would you think of such a man? Clearly you would not admire him. You would call him a gold digger. You would think him selfish at the core, dishonorable, unworthy, and you would be right. But here's my question. Is that not precisely the way in which too often we may have regarded Jesus Christ? He owns heaven. He can get us out of hell. He can get the blessings of God that will make life better for us, and so we're going to accept him. By the way, isn't that the strangest way for a Christian believer to speak about their relationship with Jesus Christ, to accept him? I mean, I would never speak about my wife in that way. You know, 34 years ago when we got married, I accepted her. I mean, you would find that an offensive way of speaking. It wouldn't enter my head. I love her. I embraced her. I gave myself to her and counted myself so privileged that she would give herself to me. A.W. Tozer sounded the alarm over what I'm calling gold digger Christianity in these words, quote, "The whole transaction of religious conversion has been made mechanical and spiritless. Christ may be, quote, received, without creating any special love for him in the soul of the receiver. The man is, quote, saved, but he is not hungry or thirsty after God." Now, friends, Tozer wrote these words in 1948. That is 66 years ago. Which means that the vast majority of us, all of our lives, have grown up breathing the air of an emaciated form of Christianity that he describes here. Gold digger Christianity. In which you make a decision in order to get out of hell, get into heaven, accept Jesus, get God on your side. Your life will be better that way, but very little love for Jesus Christ. And you open the Bible and you find a different world. You find Peter writing to real Christians and saying this, "Though you have not seen him, you love him. You love him." So I'm saying to you, beware of gold digger Christianity, the gold digger mentality. Jesus, at the end of the Bible, actually gives us a profile of what I'm calling the gold digger mentality. It's actually there in the words that Christ speaks to the church at Ephesus in Revelation in chapter 2. You may recall what he says. There are three things, basically. Jesus says to these folks, "I know your works and your toil and your patient endurance." So here are people who are hard workers in the church. Here are people who are loyal folks who stick at it with steady tenacity, show up, good people. Then he says, "I know that you cannot bear those who are evil, but you have tested those who call themselves apostles and are not, and you found them to be false." So here are people of moral integrity, can't stand evil. Here are people of doctrinal orthodoxy, discerning with regards to false claims, sticklers for being biblically orthodox. And Jesus commends all of these things, hard work, moral integrity, biblical orthodoxy. He commends them all, and then he says this, "But I've got one thing against you. You have abandoned the love that you had at first. You're doing the work. You're living the life. You're holding the line. But whatever happens to I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine, Christ is saying, I don't hear that from you. I don't hear it from you. And therefore, he says to this church in Ephesus, you've got to repent. Something's got to change because otherwise I'm going to take the candlestick away. Now, he's talking about a church, and what he's saying is how the life of a church is sustained or how the life of a church dies down. That's what the reference to the candlestick is all about. And what we learn from it is simply this, that the life of a church cannot be sustained by hard work, by moral integrity and doctrinal orthodoxy alone. The life of a church, and therefore the life of a Christian, is sustained through a vibrant love for Jesus Christ. Lose that and you lose everything. You're only left with a shell. And so beware the gold digger mentality. Beware of simply looking to Jesus Christ, to what he can give you and what he can make right and what you want in your life. Now, of course, the time when this really comes home, and these times may prove to be the sparkling moments of our Christian lives, are the moments when Jesus Christ allows us to walk in a place where we very obviously don't receive from the hand of God what we asked and what we wanted. And I want to say to you for your encouragement today, the very best place of all, the very best time of all for you to tell Christ that you really love him is when you find yourself in the middle of an experience of pain and of loss. And I say that for this reason. There is nothing very surprising about a Christian who loves God when everything in life is going well. But Christians who love the Lord, when good gifts are taken away or are withheld, they demonstrate to heaven, on earth, and in hell that they really do love God and not just his gifts. And you know, of course, that that is the main, in fact, the whole point of the book of Job, which begins with Satan slandering God. And here was his blasphemy. He comes to God and he says, now, the only reason that Job loves you, the only reason that he's living this righteous life, is that you have filled his life with blessings. You have showered him with wealth. You have surrounded him, God, with loved ones. Job is blessed. Blessed beyond measure. And he knows where his bread is buttered. And that's why he loves you. It's just because of what you give him. Now, you can understand Satan saying such a thing because hell knows nothing of love. And Satan could not believe that anyone could possibly love God for who he is. And so he slanders God by essentially accusing God of buying Job's affection. Well, you know the story. One gift after another was stripped away from Job. And this godly man then walked through a dark valley of pain. And he struggled with many, many unanswered questions. And the whole book depicts the depth of that struggle and the agonies of it. But in all of that struggle, he did not stop loving God. That's the point of the book. He did not stop loving God. Though he slay me, yet I shall trust him. I know that my Redeemer lives, and even if worms destroy this body in my flesh, I shall see God. What I'm saying to you is that when Job loved God in the middle of his pain and his suffering and his loss, his testimony glorified God in heaven, it silenced Satan in hell, and throughout thousands of years, it has brought strength to millions of Christians to persevere and to glorify God. So here's my conclusion. of all the things that you and I may do in the service of God in the course of our lives, loving Christ still in the middle of unexplained suffering and loss may prove to be the greatest contribution you will ever make to glorifying Christ and to the advance of His kingdom in the world. It's that important. Loving Christ in the face of pain and of loss glorifies God in heaven. It causes consternation in hell, and it brings strength to believers who see that God is worthy for Himself and not simply on account of His gifts. So beware of the gold digger mentality. And when you walk through a place of difficulty and suffering and loss and you love Christ still, you shoot it to bits to the glory of God and to the silencing of Satan. It's marvelous. It's that important.